On today's episode, we're going to talk about developing a consistent process for your business and a system that will help you succeed.
Let's go!
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of The Blind Entrepreneur. I'm your host, Jonathan Grzbowski, and today I have with me David Barnett. He is a private transaction advisor. David has been working to help the owners of small and medium-sized businesses for almost 20 years. As a former business broker and financing broker, David has helped people buy, sell, plan, manage, and finance businesses. Since 2014, David has authored 6 small business books, 3 of which have become Amazon bestsellers. David, that is an incredible introduction that you have there and an incredible accomplishment. Congratulations. How was your day, my friend?
It's awesome, Jonathan. Thanks for having me on your show today.
Anytime, absolutely. So we're going to talk about a wide gamut of things about businesses and maybe even potentially the Amazon bestsellers and how you got there, some tips and tricks, and even your new online course. We're extremely pumped to talk about it, but before we do, we have to start off with an icebreaker. So imagine you just had the best day of your life. What is that one piece of food that is going to make your day complete?
The one piece of food that would make my day complete would probably be a lemon square.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, we need to,
a little bit tangy, a little bit sweet. My mom used to make lemon meringue pies when I was a kid, and I've always had a love for that lemon flavor, but you know, when you're on the go, a lemon meringue pie is just too much of a task. So
not
a lemon square will have to do.
Not bad. That sounds like a good nightcap. So that's awesome. I'm sure we'll get into how important family is to you shortly, because once you bring in family, and you start off with family, they probably made such an impact on your life. So I'm excited to hear all about it. But without further ado, David, the floor is now yours. Tell us about yourself. Who are you and what is your story?
Yeah, sure. So basically, I've always been interested in business. I've always been an entrepreneur ever since I was a little kid. I always had those little businesses going, you know, mowing lawns, delivering flyers. I live in Canada. So, you know, when I was 13, I saved up enough money to buy a used snowblower so I could go do neighbors' driveways in the wintertime after snowstorms. And so I've always been looking for ways to make money. I've always been interested in business. And I went away to business school thinking that getting a business degree was going to teach me how to be a businessman. And it took me probably about 3 years to realize that business school doesn't make you into a businessman. And what it makes you into is a Fortune 500 bureaucrat where you work for someone who dropped out of school. And, you know, because I was almost done, I carried on and went through. And there are certain things that I learned in business school with respect to finance, accounting, and other sort of boring business stuff that nobody likes to think about, which is actually very valuable in my business today. I then went out from school and I started working in advertising, and I worked for the Yellow Pages from about 1998 until 2005, back when it was still a really relevant media, because if you typed plumber into Google in those days, you would get plumbing companies in California, for example. They hadn't figured out the whole local thing back then. And so I got to go out and meet with the owners and managers of all kinds of small local businesses. And I would ask them how their business worked, what their business model was, how they made money, and what kind of customer they wanted to have walk through the door or call them, because then I could try to tailor an advertising program to bring those people in. And I eventually left that business because I knew that, you know, the days of yellow page books were probably numbered, given the way technology and the internet was going. And I went out and I started a business, and I sold it after about a year and a half. And then I started another business, which was in the commercial finance space. And that's where I was brokering commercial debt. So I was helping small companies get commercial loans, commercial mortgages, operating and capital leases for equipment, what's called factoring facilities, when companies have to exchange receivables for cash using a third party to help cash flow. And I was doing all that kind of work until the financial crisis hit in 07, 08. Literally half the businesses I was using as sources of capital for my clients went out of business during that crisis. And I started looking for something new to do. And one of the things that I had consistently come across when I was brokering commercial debt is that there were all these people trying to buy businesses and they weren't getting the right help or advice. So I went into the world of business brokerage, and I joined an international franchise brand, mostly because they had the resources to give me training to help teach me what I needed to know to do a good job. And I actually became the first person in my region to become certified in helping people buy and sell businesses. And I did a brokerage office the traditional way for about 3 years. I sold 36 companies for other people. And by any measure, I was one of the most successful business brokers in my area. But what those statistics don't really tell you is that in those 3 years, I went through three droughts of about 9 months each. So while business brokers, they earn commissions based on when the company sells and how much it sells for, the cash flow is a nightmare. So, you know, I had some checks, you know, there were deals I worked on where I earned over $80,000, but then you pay off your lines of credit and your credit cards, then you're afraid to spend the money because you can't be certain when the next deal is going to close. And so, you know, all the gray hair you see on the side here, it all comes from being a business broker. And eventually I had to get out of it. And I realized this doesn't work for me. It doesn't work for my clients. They hate writing those giant checks. And it doesn't necessarily work for the buyers because there's an inherent conflict there. I learned pretty quick that I was only ever going to be able to make money selling a business to someone who was suited to it. But in the world of business brokers and business brokerage, buyers have to beware because they're getting advice sometimes from people who have an interest in them buying a business, whether or not they're going to be successful. The broker is going to be paid by the seller. So when I eventually left the industry, I took a little detour into another career in banking and then got drawn back into the world of buying and selling businesses in a completely new way. So the way that I work with people today is I work with buyers and sellers, but my relationship with them is much more similar to a relationship you would have with an accountant or a lawyer. I work from a menu of services, and I coach and advise and do consulting work with people and bring them through the process of either buying or selling. And I'm not conflicted in any way because I just work for the buyer or the seller. And basically, they pay me for what I do. So my own personal cash flow is a lot smoother. I'm issuing invoices every week. And the people who hire me to help them sell their businesses, they end up paying much less because instead of a big commission at the end, they just pay me for the advice that I give them along the way. So it works out a lot better. The buyers that I work with can have confidence that I'm strictly, you know, in their corner with them. And a lot of the times, I give them advice that a business broker never would, in that I look at a deal and I go, this deal sucks and you should not buy this business. So it makes it easier for me as well on a personal level. So that's what I do today, Jonathan. I know it's a big story.
No, it's a good story. I mean, we need to know the context before you start giving advice. But you mentioned earlier that you have like a new series that you're working on.
Yeah.
I would love to hear a little bit more about that, and more specifically, how is it helping people? Or entrepreneurs.
Sure. When I started my first real grown-up business, is what I'll call it, after my career with the Yellow Pages, I read the book E-Myth by Michael Gerber, where he talks about how, you know, the most small businesses are actually started by technicians. You know, so the roofer knows how to install shingles and decides that they're going to start a roofing company, for example, or the auto mechanic knows how to fix cars. He decides to start a service center. So, and they're not really run by entrepreneurs, who are people who build and design businesses. So when I got into that first business, I actually sat down and I created org charts, job descriptions, process workflows, tools to manage workflow. I wrote an operations manual that was over 30 pages long. And this was before we even opened the doors, which is what Gerber advised. And later in life, when I decided to sell that business, it was sold to the second person I showed it to, who got excited. And what got them excited was not necessarily the numbers of what we did, but how we ran the business, because I was literally able to work for about 90 minutes a day on that business. All the employees knew exactly what they needed to do, and they would go out every day and earn money for me. And the buyer looked at it and went, holy cow, I need to buy your business because I want to take these systems and adapt them to my other businesses that he was already in. And so, and then that was it, right? That chapter of my life closed. Later, when I became a business broker, I was working with people who were trying to sell businesses. And back to that Michael Gerber book, E-Myth, they were technical people who were running everything in their head. They had no processes written down. They didn't know how to properly manage their business. I met people who worked for 20 years who never had a vacation because they couldn't delegate and organize themselves to the point where other people would be able to do things just day to day in the business. So I would meet these people, they wanted to sell, and I would say, look, we can sell your business, but the way it is today, we can only sell this business to somebody exactly like you, who has the same skills, the same experience, and the same knowledge. And that's a small pool of people. If we can take some of the ideas from this e-myth book and we can put them into your business, I can then show other people who don't have the same experience and knowledge that they can run the business just by following the systems and methods that you've put together. And people would nod and say, yeah, that's a great idea. And then they wouldn't do it. And at one point, I even bought people copies of the book and said, here, just read it and do what he says. And they wouldn't read the book or they wouldn't do it. And, you know, back in those days, I believed, Jonathan, that people existed on a continuum between smart and not so smart. And I couldn't understand why these clearly intelligent, smart people who owned and operated these businesses couldn't follow my simple advice, which was just to create these systems. Much later in life, I learned about things like the different personality tests, like your DISC profiles and the Myers-Briggs test, for example, with the 16 different personality types. And then I learned why it was so simple to me because of my particular personality type. I'm very well suited to sitting down, imagining how things should be, and then building a plan to get there. So I said, you know what I need to do is I actually need to take some of this business system advice and apply it to making business systems, okay? So it's like creating a plan for planning, right? So I actually created this 13-step process that people can go through where every step is very simple and very easy, but it allows you to take an existing operating business and systematize it entirely from start to finish. And most people can do this while they're running their company. I've had people do it as fast as 4 months, and some people do it in a year. And I've got some people who are still working on it after about 2 years. But it just depends on the level of commitment and how much time they're willing to invest. But even the guys that are pushing the years, the advantages of doing the steps they've already achieved have already helped them double the size of their business. So I show people and I teach them through my program step by step how you go about creating a complete operating system for your business so that anybody else could come in and understand exactly who does what, who's responsible for what. And then the other advantages beyond that are huge because it means that employees now know the process of the company from start to finish. So they don't have to run to you and say, who does this or who are we supposed to get to do this? They can all refer to the tool and find out who's responsible for what. And then of course, it becomes easy to hold people accountable to things. It becomes easy to do employee reviews, and it becomes easy to grow because once sales start to grow, you know, many entrepreneurs face a problem of, I know I need help, but I don't know what the new person will do, and I don't know how I'm going to train them. Once you've gone through this program that I use with people, you'll actually have an org chart and all the processes, and you'll say, I need a new person. Here's my choke point right here. I'm going to put them into this role, and I'm going to move those responsibilities away from these other two existing employees. And literally the day the person starts, you can hand them the job descriptions of the roles that they're going to fill and show them where in the process their part fits in. So it's very mechanical, just like, you know, people talk about things like a McDonald's franchise, right? It's all put together. Everyone knows what they're supposed to be doing. And, you know, the employees show up for work. And if their job is the cook, they know exactly what their responsibilities are. And everything that they do in that role is perfectly systematized.
And so I'm a business, you know, I'm struggling. I could possibly be I'm giving you a hypothetical situation, a possible client that is in need of your new series. Mm-hmm. What are some things that I need to do off the bat, day one, to get myself ready or prepared for what it is that you're about to, the knowledge you're about to drop on us?
Basically, when I work with people, I often get called in by people I know, like bankers or people that I've worked with before. And it's usually driven by crisis, unfortunately. So people get into some kind of cash flow crisis or jam or problem in their business, and they look for help. And unfortunately, that's when most people stop and actually work on their business, is when there's some sort of crisis. And so when that happens, I go in, I look at a business, I look for Band-Aid solutions for immediate problems to help get them through the day. And then I go to the financial statements. Because what I find in a lot of cases is small businesses that don't have what are called the chart of accounts set up properly to manage their type of business. So I'll give you an example. I had a client that I started working with a few months ago. They purchase and sell a product, and they also install it. Okay. And on their profit and loss statement, they had one line for wages and salaries. And immediately that raised a flag for me, because I said, look, the guys who are going out and doing installations and the people who are doing sales, their efforts are directly related to the sales being made, right? So their wages need to actually be part of the cost of goods sold, whereas the owner of the company and the administrative staff that stay in the office, that's part of the overhead. So we had to put some of the wages into the cost of goods sold, some of the wages into the overhead, because at the end of the day, what was happening is he was calculating a markup on his goods, but without being able at the end of every month to quickly look and calculate his gross margin, he didn't know if the markup he was applying to the goods was actually leading to the gross margin he needed, right? And so financials, you know, people talk a lot about KPIs, key performance indicators, and they look at different numbers in their business. And what a lot of entrepreneurs miss sight of is the fact that the accounting people have literally spent the last 300 years trying to figure out the most accurate and best way to represent what's going on in a business on paper. And most entrepreneurs don't even want to look at those pieces of paper. And the problem with a lot of them is that they have never been set up properly to give people the management information that they need. So that's the second thing I do with people, is I look at their books and look at their numbers and say, are we getting the actual information that we need on it quickly at the end of every month to know if there's a problem? People run into big problems when they treat accounting like some awful thing that has to be done to deal with taxes, because what then ends up happening is, you know, 6 months into the new year, you end up with all of your numbers and tax returns and everything finally prepared. And then you find out you have a problem. Well, you're working with 18-month-old data, right? And if a problem's already been around for 18 months, now you have to try to fix it. This is how companies get into trouble with cash, and they end up dying because they're not responsive enough. They don't have that information coming back to them. So once we know that the company has proper data and that everything is working well, then I say, now we have something in place that we're going to systematize. You don't want to systematize something that's broken.
Totally. Yeah, without a doubt. So imagine, you know, a startup right now listening to this conversation, and they're getting a ton of ideas on how to systemize. What would you recommend to the startup who has absolutely, or even the small business that has absolutely no capital to be a part of something that you're offering? What is the one thing that they could do right now, today, in their business that can better them in the future?
Well, it's actually to start the business and be building the business with systems in place. And it's not a big amount of capital or anything. The online program that I offer is $200, Jonathan. It's not a big investment at all. It's an investment in time. So they have to actually, you know, watch the videos, work through the materials, and set themselves up. And one of the things that I challenge people with in my program is that you don't actually set up the systems for the business as it is today. What you do is you create a sketch of what the business looks like in the future. So you have to determine, what kind of business am I building? So, you know, one of my clients, for example, they have a business, they do about $1 million in sales. And I ask the owner, the first step is, what does your life look like in 10 years? And so how much money do you earn? How many weeks of vacation do you take? Where do you go on vacation? Do you own a vacation property, or do you have one of those big trailers you haul around? Like, what is your life looking like? Where do the kids and the grandkids come to meet you, right? And so they sketch out this detailed view of what their life looks like. And I say, all right, so you're telling me you're going to have this vacation home or the big trailer, and you're going to have all these grandkids around, and you're going to have $250,000 income. What does the company look like that is going to be able to provide you with that lifestyle? So now we realize that the company that does $1 million in sales isn't adequate to provide that for him. So what do we really need to be looking at? A company that does $3 million in sales, let's say. So then we design our org chart as it would look like in a company that does $3 million in sales. And then step by step, we go through all the systematization, job descriptions, et cetera. And then I show people in the 12-step program how we then navigate from where we are today into that, you know, grow into those shoes, so to speak. But by starting with the plan of what we're building, we now have direction. We know where we're going. And one of the, you know, I when I'm doing my workshops, I always talk about the definitions because people get confused by words. Let me give an example. People will often use business, company, and corporation interchangeably. They'll think that they're the same things, and they're not. A corporation is a legal structure, which is a legal person that owns things. A business is when money, space, and capital and people work together to produce a cash flow. So I'll often have people say, well, I own this business. I'll say, let's take a look at it. And if you have an economic activity going on and it produces a cash flow to you as an owner, which is less than you would earn if you worked for somebody else doing the same work, then I don't call that a business. I call it a hobby because you're literally putting free labor into this thing to make it work, right? And if you have an economic activity which produces a cash flow equal to what you would earn if you were working somewhere else, then again, I don't call it a business. That's called a job. So you own your own job because it pays you what you would earn someplace else. And so then if we have an economic activity going on where you get to pay yourself a fair market wage, and then there's extra money left over at the end of the day after that. So not only are you working and earning a wage that you would earn from somebody else, but your investment of capital has now produced some kind of dividend in surplus. That's a real business, Jonathan. Now, the other thing that we have going on out there is a speculative venture. And a speculative venture is not a business. It's us putting effort, capital, labor, et cetera, into something that we hope will one day pay off. So when I'm speaking in front of a group of people, what I will often do is I'll draw the analogy between the oil company that, you know, the refining company, and, you know, think about the refining company. They buy crude oil, they run it through their big machine, they make gasoline, they sell it. They do the same thing every day, they make money every day, right? And you compare that to the wildcat drilling outfit where they get some money together, they buy a drill rig, and they literally go out and punch holes in the ground hoping to find oil, right? That's a speculative venture because if they don't find oil fast enough, they're going to die. And today we have this startup culture largely based around the internet where people are putting time, effort, resources, and attracting capital, and they're spending all this money to try to make something that will one day pay off. It's not a business. It's a speculative venture. And even within a speculative venture, you have to figure out where are we going with this? What will it look like in 10 years' time when it has matured into a business? And that the same rules and methods that I use in my 12-step process apply to that speculative venture. They have to know where they're headed. Now, I know it changes, right? You know, people are on one course, they learn new things, and they have to change course. And that's why it's important to build your plan as a living document so that when the course has to be changed, we can easily change all of this stuff. And now we have a new course set.
Now, I'm just curious when it comes to, and I'm sure, you know, the amount of information you just gave in that brief moment was a lot, and it was really good stuff. But would you recommend, digitizing this document? Do you have any tips and tricks in order for people to kind of do it on their own for the time being, and then gradually add on to it?
Yeah, well, I mean, the tool that I use with people when we move through this process is Excel. Oh, okay. So it's not a document like a big book that gets produced. It's an Excel spreadsheet with a couple of different tabs. Mm-hmm. And the reason why it's done that way is so that it's adaptable and easily changed. And then when we use the tool, once it's built, we use like the sorting features and everything. So at one point in my process, you've got all the tasks and responsibilities going on in a company listed out in this spreadsheet, and then you have them assigned to the different roles. And then if you need a new employee comes on, you need a job description, you just simply sort.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Here you go. Here's the job description. Here's the list of tasks that belong to this role. So it's all about using the technology, because, you know, in the olden days of organizational planning, what would happen is consultants would come into a company, they would design, you know, an org chart, and they would make job descriptions. They would put it all together in this book, and everyone would say how great the book looked and how nice it was and how great it was to have a plan. And then some change would happen in the organization. All of a sudden the book didn't match, but nobody wants to pay the consultants to come back and change it. Right. And then you end up with this plan on the shelf that nobody actually uses. And that's why when I work with people, I say, no, we need to develop something. And keep in mind, I put this program together with the idea that it was going to help business owners get their business ready to sell. And the idea is you show this to a buyer and you say, look, this is our business. It's how everything runs. And when buyers see that everything's organized like that, even if they know that they're going to take the company in a new direction, they can see that they can just adapt all this stuff that's already built. And it's having that work done, which creates such tremendous value. I've got a client right now that I'm working with to go through this. They're only in the third step, but even at the third step, he's already said, you know what? I've now identified people in this company who are underemployed. Like, they have certain duties and responsibilities. I didn't realize that they actually have time on their hands. I can give them more stuff. So as people go through the process, they in fact learn much more about their own organization and can make improvements along the way. It also makes it harder for people to, you know, you ever see the movie Office Space?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So in the movie Office Space, there's a couple of characters who don't really seem to do much,
right,
but they hold a role and they get a paycheck. Well,
right,
you know, when you organize everything and systematize everything and you document everything that everyone does and what their roles and responsibilities are, it becomes really hard for people to hide in an organization who aren't really contributing value.
Interesting. That's a really good point. And I think we could all look at our businesses and realize and think of a couple of employees or even just like a couple of workers that we know that we can probably get more out of. So it's good to kind of just ask yourself that question and then build a plan around it and hopefully, you know, work with an individual like yourself. If it's okay with you, I'd like to kind of shift focus a little bit about your books.
Yeah.
Because it's something that I think can be extremely valuable to people who are listening today. You wrote several books. Some of them became Amazon bestsellers. Are there any, I guess, tips and tricks that you found in order to become an Amazon bestseller? Because I feel like that's such a good milestone to obtain when writing a book. Yeah, the book is to provide value. The book is to provide, you know, X, but you also want to get it in front of the people that would inevitably want to read it. So is there anything that you can speak to about that?
Yeah, sure. Becoming an Amazon bestseller is kind of formulaic, you know. Basically, if you write a book and its category on Amazon is like romance novels, you know, good luck becoming a bestseller. You're going to have to sell like a million copies in the first month or something, right? So my books, of course, are about small business and entrepreneurship and investing and finance and stuff like this. So there's smaller categories that are less busy. So it's easier to find your way up to the top. And then it has to do with, you know, having a following. So where I'm at now with my email list and my YouTube subscribers, and my iTunes subscribers and all that kind of stuff, I'm at a point now when I come out and I release something new, I can get enough people to buy it right off the bat. And Amazon, they update their bestseller list every hour based on 24 hours of sales. So if you can get enough people to buy all at once, you can actually get into the rankings. And once you're in the rankings, Amazon itself will start to then promote to other people you don't know, saying, hey, look, here's a book that's on fire. You know, it's really moving up the ranks and it's active in a category that those particular people are interested in. So if people buy books from the entrepreneurship category and you get a book in there that starts moving up the ranks, those people will receive an email saying, hey, have you checked out this new title that's really popular in a category that you like? So initially, off the bat, you have to have a plan. So you write the new book, you don't just release it and start telling a few people. You have to have a plan so that you make a splash, so that when you release it, as many people as possible are going to buy it on that release day. And that's what gives it that kickstart to have it moving up the scale.
I think the theme that of this conversation is just setting a proper plan. And if you don't have a plan, yeah, you have to stick to it. And if you don't have a plan, you have to create it. And if you have a plan, you have to stick to it. So,
well, consistency.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is what's going to win the game every time. Like, I mean, right now I work with people literally all around the world and helping them buy and sell businesses. And the reason that I'm able to attract clients from all over the place is my marketing program, which is simply to every week, once a week, I release a new video on YouTube. And it also comes out in an email, and the audio goes over to iTunes, etc. And so every week it's like another hook in the ocean for people to find based on search engine, optimization stuff. So when people, it's funny, I often get comments from people that they'll go looking for information on buying and selling a business, and maybe they'll get a Google result that will lead them to somebody's video that isn't mine, but they'll watch the video. And then at the end of the video, there might be 12 or 16 different suggested videos that YouTube will put in front of them. And people will say, man, I watched this video from this guy about buying a business, and at the end on the suggested videos, 9 of them were you. And they go, so I just knew, wow, who's this guy who has all of this information? And then once they start watching my videos, of course, people do business with people that they know, like, and trust. And that's why YouTube is such a powerful platform, because people can, they can watch my videos, learn a ton of information for free, and then get to know me. And so what typically happens in my business is people will start watching videos or listening to audios. Then they'll buy a couple of my books and they'll read them, and maybe they'll do an online course. And the biggest part of what I do as a consultant, I liken to insurance. So I recently had a client, for example, down in Texas, who was looking at buying a business, and he's looking at a couple $100,000 investment. Well, it's easy to justify reaching out to me and saying, Dave, I want to work with you to make sure this is a good deal and what I'm doing is making sense, because I don't want to make a $200,000 mistake. Right. And so basically, that's what I do. I work with people all over, either to buy and sell. And it's for sellers, it's about getting the right price and selling in a timely manner. Some of the biggest mistakes that sellers make is they'll overprice the business to the point where they scare off what I call the reasonable buyers. So a reasonable buyer is someone who has money in the bank, they've got good credit, they've got retirement savings. They know the industry, they know how to run this type of business, and they will have done research, and they will know, these machine shops, they sell for a certain multiple of earnings or a certain percentage of sales. If your asking price is way out of line with the information that's available to buyers, what they're going to say is, hey, here's a person who doesn't know what they're doing. They're a bit of a nut. I can't waste my time trying to negotiate with someone whose expectations are so out of whack. So the person who overprices the business, they never meet the reasonable buyers. And who they meet instead are the buyers who don't know what they're doing, or the tire kickers who will make lowball offers on everything, right? And the reality is that people very rarely sell privately controlled companies to cash out, okay? That's something that happens in the news and in movies. Businesses can only be sold for an amount of money that makes sense given the risk of the industry and the cash flow that's there. And so no one's going to buy a small business and pay a person 10 times its cash flow, because what you would be doing is you'd be actually saying as a buyer, I'm so confident in this small business that for the next 10 years, I'm willing to simply work for free to get back my investment. And then I'll earn my profit in year 11, right? Business is too risky for that. People need to get their money back in a couple of years. And so when sellers go to look at what their business is worth and they learn that it's only worth a couple times cash flow, many of them won't sell because they need the business. They need the cash flow, right? So then who sells a business? Well, it's people suffering from burnout, people that need to retire, people that are getting a divorce, people that have been told by their doctor they have, health issue, or people that need to relocate. think of a couple where one person is a highly paid employee or maybe something like a military officer, and the other spouse owns a business which is successful, but maybe doesn't earn as much as the spouse who's an officer. So when a redeployment comes and they have to move, that business is going to go up for sale so the couple can stay together, right? And so businesses go up for sale because of pressing personal needs. And when you have a pressing personal need, what becomes important then is time. How can we find the buyer, make the deal, and move on in the quickest way that will get us the most value? The other thing that happens when people finally make that decision that they're going to sell a business, if it's because they're fed up and tired of the business, you know, because burnout and fatigue is actually one of the number one reasons people sell a private business. Think about a job that you've had for 15 years. You know, when an employee gets tired of a job, they go looking for a new one. But when a business owner gets tired of what they're doing, they can't just quit because a great deal of their family's net worth is tied up in the business. They need to find a buyer to move on. But now that the passion is gone, the effect will be that sales will start to decline, earnings will start to decline because their heart isn't in it anymore. They're not coming back to work at 7:30 at night to return those calls that they weren't able to return during the day. When they're fed up, they're checking out earlier and earlier. And what that will do is ultimately the cash flow will decline and the value of the business will decline. So once the decision's been made by someone, I need to sell, it's got to be done quickly. So from both sides, there are issues that people come up with, and that's what I help them with, basically.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, great points. We're going to shift the focus completely now and go a little bit personal.
Okay.
Because I you know, you're obviously knowledgeable and about business, but we also need to make sure that, you know, you're a great human as well, which I'm sure you are.
Okay.
The question is very simple. I was asked this and I couldn't answer it, so I'm going to ask it to you as well. But of all these amazing things that you do in order to help people in business, what do you do for fun?
Oh, I go into the forest.
Really?
Yeah, it's as simple as that.
Is that why you have the beard now? Or
yeah. I went away on a vacation with my girlfriend. She liked the scruff that was coming in, so it was decided that the beard would stay.
But expand on that. What do you mean by you go into the forest?
Yeah, I think that, you know, people for thousands of years, you know, they lived in nature, right? We're part of the natural world. And so there's a big part of us, I think, that belongs there. And I always find that if I'm feeling a bit stressed out or I feel like there's a lot of work piled up or a little bit overwhelmed, all I have to do is go for a walk in the woods. I'm lucky I live two blocks from a nice park here in the city where there's a couple of kilometers of trails that I can go on. And I actually also live close to a long distance trail. It goes for about 30 miles from my hometown here to a national park. So, and I've done that. I can do that in about 2 days. So it's, I like to get into the woods. I also enjoy mountain biking and taking my bike. There's some trails around here too, through the forest. And my two kids, they're 7 and 9 years old and they're involved in scouting, and I'm a scout leader too. So nice. I take them out. They're in Cubs right now. So
nice. Yeah. So not only are you a great businessman, but you're a good father as well.
well, you know, it's funny because, you know, we talked a lot about planning. So planning is, I think, paramount to happiness. And what I think far too few people do is they actually sit down and they go, what kind of life do I want to have? So I'm a single dad, I'm divorced. So I knew that I did not want to be the dad who worked 60 hours a week to pay for daycare so somebody else could take care of the kids and I could see them for an hour and a half at night before they went to bed. So I built the business I have today so that I can work from 8:30 in the morning until 1:30 in the afternoon. And then I can be the person that takes care of the kids after school. And so my whole business is built around my own vision of what my life was supposed to be. And my desires in life are based around what I want for my kids. Because I was lucky enough to grow up in a family with no divorce. You know, my mom was a stay-at-home mom. And I actually went home for lunch every day from school and, you know, went back home after school and got to play in the forest and build forts and all that kind of stuff. And I want to make sure that my kids have the same opportunity as much as possible to enjoy life and to spend time with me and get to know me. And so you know, the clock is ticking, because I think about the time they turn 12 or 13 or 14, they no longer want to hang out with their parents as much. And so that's why I know I need to invest the next couple of years in making sure that they have those great childhood memories before they start to spread their wings a little and spend more time, you know, out of the nest as teenagers, you know, do with their friends and stuff.
Time is ticking, my friend.
Yeah.
You mentioned the, what was it, the lemon squares in the beginning?
Yeah.
How important was your upbringing, and how is it correlated to, you know, who you are as a person today?
Oh, well, I think it was fundamental, obviously. I mean, the values that I adopted from my parents, it's kind of funny, where my mom has passed now, but me and my dad are very similar in some ways and very different in other ways. So he was an engineer and he worked for the government. So, you know, here he had this kid who was interested in business and selling stuff and being a salesman, and it was all kinds of things that he really didn't have much to share with me, because his life was about the old, you know, the old paradigm, right? He was the first kid in his family to go to university, and then immediately right out of university, he got that job, which turned into a 30-year career, right? And that plan sort of isn't as viable now as it once was. But he taught me that you have to be truthful and you have to be honest and you have to have integrity, and that if you truly care about what other people are doing, and you help other people, then it's going to come around to you. So every business that I've ever been in, one of the reasons why I don't have a problem selling is because I know that I'm actually serving. Right. So people come to me because they need help. People come to me because they don't want to make a big mistake. People come to me because they need to achieve something like selling their business in a quick and timely manner. And by helping them achieve their ends, I get paid. Right. And so I don't have a problem with, you know, asking people for money. I don't have a problem showing them how my service is going to help them, because I know that the people that I've done business with consistently over the course of time, are all going to look back at their interactions with me and say, hey, he helped me do what I needed to do, and I've gotten where I needed to go because of Dave's help. And, you know, for anyone that ever has problems doing sales, I always bring it back to the Walmart example. And so, you know, if you are a parent, one of your responsibilities is to make sure that your children have proper footwear, right? And so you go into the Walmart and you find rubber boots for your child and they're $10. Do you begrudge Walmart because you paid them $10? Do you think, oh my God, you know, this is such a terrible thing, I have to hand over $10? No, you think, geez, the problem of properly giving my kids proper footwear on a winter day or a rainy day has been solved by me just giving them $10. So Walmart has removed a problem from a parent's life in exchange for $10. Whereas if Walmart wasn't there, how on earth would we give our children proper footwear for a rainy day? If I had to make rubber boots on my own, I could tell you it would take a lot of time and probably cost me more than $10, right? So people, they hand over money because they need or want things, right? It's not because you're asking them to do you a favor, which is often people's mental block when it comes to sales. They go, geez, I feel bad about asking for money. And the first thing I'll say is, well, do you provide something that's going to give value to the client? Are you saving them money or helping them earn more money or solving a problem for them? And so why would you not want to get into it as front of as many people as possible and show those people how you can make their life easier simply by them handing over some money, right? That's what sales is. Yeah. It's showing people an opportunity and helping them solve their problems.
Absolutely. I have three more questions. We're going to try and go rapid fire. All right. So then we can get the an exact answer, because I'm curious to know tech that you use.
Technology
any,
I use?
Yeah, technology that you use that you can't live without. Any apps or maybe some, you know, whatever it may be.
Yeah, it's having stuff in the cloud. So Google Drive, Google Sheets, Google Forms, that kind of thing. And so me and so many of my clients have done so many amazing things just with Google Forms. Nice. Right? And it's free and easy.
Absolutely. What about habits? Is there a particular habit that you just do constantly every single day?
Well, number one is to make sure that I get outside, even if it's just walking my kids to school to get some kind of physical activity. And number two, I use a calendar religiously and I use time blocks. So when somebody asks me to do something or I get an email where I'm supposed to do something on behalf of a client, immediately, I don't use a list of to-dos. Immediately what I do is I go on my calendar and I block out time that I think is going to take me to do that job or task. And the rule is that some of the blocks can move, but they can't be deleted. And when they're done, they should be in the past. So on a busy day, if I can't get things done, I just simply move blocks around. But it's a way for me to plan and know what my commitments are so that when someone says, how quickly can you do this? I can look at my calendar and go, wow, for the next 3 days, I have a bunch of these blocks. I can only do it for you for next week. And, you know, going back to sales, one of the biggest problems I find that people have in business is that they feel like they need to do things immediately or quickly to get people's business. In reality, people don't get disappointed by not having fast customer service. They get disappointed when their expectations aren't met. So if you say to someone, yes, I can do it for you sometime next week, and you don't do it next week, it takes longer, they're going to be disappointed. If you tell somebody, I can do it for you right away, and you take till next week, they're going to be disappointed. But if you tell them up front when it's going to be done and then you deliver on time, they're happy.
Interesting. Well, yeah. You know, I think the amount of information that you've given us today has been an astronomical amount. And I hope that this is an episode that people read over and over and over again. Right now, the podcast is officially completed. I would like for you to just look into the camera and give us about a 30-second spiel of how people can find you, how people can be a part of your journey, how can they watch all of your content. The floor is yours, my friend.
Sure. Well, the main place online for me is my blog site, which is davidcbarnett.com with two T's at the end of Barnett. And if you're interested in the 12-step program, there's a URL for that. It's easysmallbizsystems.com. And then I've got, from my blog site, you're going to be able to find under the Work with David tab links to other websites I have that are specifically for buyers or sellers. And there's links there under the education tab where it can lead you over to YouTube and things like that. But basically, if you go looking for David C. Barnett, you're going to find me. I try to be in as many different places as I can.
Awesome, man. Well, again, thank you, everybody, for listening and watching the video. And thank you for always liking and commenting and subscribing. If you find a lot of value in this video, give it a thumbs up for us, please. And without further ado, David, thank you so much for your time and have a good rest of your day.
Thanks, man. It was great to be on here, Jonathan.
Likewise. Thank you so much for watching this video. Don't forget to follow me on any and all social media platforms using the long last name above, followed by the letter J. If you want to get lost into the dark abyss of YouTube, click either left or right for another video. And finally, don't forget to hit the subscribe button. No, seriously, don't forget.